leaders.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world.
Change.
GP made this one right here. You know it's a hit.
Impact.
Liberation is a praxis of action, team reflection upon the world.
Welcome to the pedagogy
Justice.
Of the obsessed.
Hey y'all, since we started this podcast, the goal has been to be intentional about our relationship with power, and that includes how we think about both whose stories are told and who tells the story. This week, we give up the mic to our first guest hosts. Marissa Alberti and Amanda Dudley talk to students, families, and teachers and researchers to explore how schools help kids succeed in a linguistically diverse nation. So listen up to this episode, Voices Unedited. If you have a story to share about school, record it and hit us up on Twitter so that we can share this platform. This is Adam signing in from Dallas this week at the New Teacher Center Symposium in order to hand off to Marissa and Amanda. Talk to you next week.
I'm Mia and I'm 9 years old.
I'm Kai and I'm 10 years old.
So what languages do you speak?
A bit of French.
Very little. Like a bit of French, Dutch.
No, I don't speak Dutch.
I mean, like, mom's on the lake.
Yeah.
A bit of French, a very tiny bit of Dutch and German, a tiny bit of Japanese, and a lot of Spanish and English.
A bit of French, barely any Dutch.
Do you think it's important to be able to speak different languages?
Yeah.
Why?
Because, like, if you're in Spain, like, if you don't know any Spanish, it'll be hard to get around.
So what's it like to learn in a dual language classroom?
It's a lot like everybody's talking, like, usually, like, one language or the other a lot of the time. Because a lot of people are familiar with English, so honestly, I hear a bit more English.
Just tell us about your experience with dual language for the kids and why you chose that for your kiddos.
I think for a couple of reasons. I think the practicality of speaking another language is obviously there. I think in the district we used to be in, there wasn't as much rigor in the schools as there is in this district. And so the addition of learning a second language added rigor. And so that was the second reason. For me, I'm very much a developmentalist at heart. I think the idea of, you know, establishing more neural pathways as your brain is learning multiple languages and the code switching and all that, I feel like it just really increases both the challenge and both the challenge of learning and the capacity to learn in the future. And so for me, that was the biggest reason, but for the other two reasons as well.
I think too that, so in Elias in San Francisco, it was very segregated, the school system, and I think the dual immersion is one place where I think there is much more integration. And I think in particular so there's quite a disparity of, you know, like in test scores or whatever, and even in kindergarten, I would say entering kindergartners, generally, the Latino students have less exposure to pre-K and different things, but then students like our kids had much more access to pre-K. But I think dual immersion actually brings it together, where our students together, where the Latino students have strengths that like our kids don't have, and so there's like a real sharing of strengths that doesn't occur necessarily in English-only environment, so then you would just perpetuate sort of the inequity, like, from kindergarten on. So, you know, like, our kids were probably, like, had been in pre-K and had been exposed to, like, a lot more, like, I don't know, literacy, like, writing, you know, different things, writing, reading, I think, just in general, than many of the, not all, but many of the Latino students, but I think in kindergarten, you could see the exchange of strengths happening, you know? So, whereas, like, our kids might be able to to help with like some literacy skills that they might have. The Latino students who speak Spanish were able to provide the strength of Spanish and actually act as, because in kindergarten it was 90% Spanish, 10% English. So there would be really this like strength-based approach.
Part of the function, hopefully, at the Low Immersion, right, is to sort of a interchange of cultural appreciation for everybody who's there, right? And I think on the one hand, just the knowledge of being in that environment and realizing not everybody is the same as me is huge, particularly for developing kids, right? Like, it's like, oh, my way isn't the only way.
Hi, my name is Amanda Dudley, and I grew up in the North Texas area and was a teacher and a principal in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex.
Hi, I'm Marissa Alberti. I'm originally from Oklahoma City area, and I'm a former teacher, and I was a chief of staff at an education nonprofit in Oklahoma. We began the journey of this project thinking about our experiences supporting both educators and students in our home states of Oklahoma and Texas. We noticed that as our states grew in immigrant population size, our educators weren't equipped to handle the multiple languages spoken in their classrooms. English language learners do not receive the same opportunities for success in our K-12 education system. Initially, we wanted to explore how to support students whose home language is one other than Spanish or English, as we noticed that this was often a forgotten group.
As we researched, however, we found that language development and supporting English language learners generally lacked in content and relevance. So we broadened our research and recognized the problem seemed to not be in the instructional strategies, but more in the adaptive work of our citizens and those in power to realize that our nation's school children are a vibrant tapestry of cultures and languages that could serve to strengthen our place on the global stage.
You just heard from the Iwasaki family, a multi-ethnic and multilingual family. Kentaro and Sabrina Iwasaki have chosen to make sure their children, Kai and Mia, are exposed to multiple languages and understand and value the diversity of the world.
Next in our podcast, we will pose the challenge of ensuring that all students from any background or home language receive education that propels them to opportunities. We share some of the most current best practices in EL education and explore the barriers to these opportunities through interviewing a roundtable of educators from the field. Then we will summarize our findings through an exploration of the root cause of inequities for ELs and pose potential next steps for moving our nation forward in this area.
According to the 1982 Plyer v. Doe court case, the United States is required to educate all children, K-12, regardless of their or their parents' immigrant status. Yet the reality is that immigrant and EL students are far behind academically. According to the Office of English Language Acquisition, approximately 10% of students in U.S. schools are English language learners. ELs in U.S. public schools are reported as speaking over 400 different types of languages and dialects, the top five being Spanish, Arabic, Chinese, Vietnamese, and Somali.
According to NAEP, ELs and non-EL reading and math scores have largely remained stagnant since 2007. The significant gap between ELs and their peers remained essentially unchanged between 2007 and 2017.
Although the gap is slightly decreasing, as of 2016, the gap between graduation rates for ELs and the national average persisted at 17%. Though the graduation rate is increasing at a higher rate than the national average, it is still only at 70%, while the national average is 84%.
Over 963,000 ELs were enrolled in high schools and U.S. public schools in the school year of 2015-16. Only 6% of high school students and approximately 10% of all students in U.S. public schools were ELs in the 15-16 school year. And of the EL students in high school, they are less likely to enroll in advanced math and science courses, and on average, only 2.8% took the ACT or the SAT.
Notice the stark difference between the picture we are painting for you and the Iwasaki family. The injustice lies in that difference. What would it take for every student in America to receive an education where they are affirmed, valued, and prepared to succeed in an increasingly linguistically diverse and globalized society? Difference, we have found, is often judged according to snap judgments around looks, appearance, and, as we explore in this podcast, language.
Throughout our journey writing this podcast, we have come to the conclusion that in order to sustain and grow strong programs that support students whose home languages differ from English, our country must first begin to do the heart work of seeing our nation as one that becomes more beautiful and ready for a 21st century world when we embrace and celebrate difference. Research only tells part of the story. So we wanted to hear from educators in the field doing this work every day to learn from their experiences as well. We were moved by their passion and their hope, and we hope that you will feel inspired by them too.
I'm Claire Hagan-Alvarado, and I am currently in the EBLD program, my second year. I'm coming from Austin. I was the language arts supervisor there for the Austin Independent School District. So I worked on language arts programming, including curriculum and professional development with the team, leading a team for pre-K-12, and we also did the Spanish language arts curriculum and worked really closely with our multilingual team. And I do this work because I started teaching third grade in Southwest Houston, and I had kids from 13 different language backgrounds in my first classroom, had no idea what I was doing, and it drives a lot of my background experiences as well as my path as a teacher and honing in on how to support so many languages at once as an ESL teacher, and then later thinking about dual language and how we hone in on two languages or more in classroom settings.
My name is Christopher Berry. I'm the Director of Language and Cultural Services in Oklahoma City Public Schools. Language and Cultural Services is basically our Title III department. And I think I got into the work for a number of reasons. First and foremost, I had a lot of friends coming up and growing up that were English learners, and watching them try to walk between two or three different worlds at once was an interesting experience. It was very eye-opening. And then as I got into teaching, having, like you, very much very similar, having students that were English learners and really thoroughly enjoying working with them and finding a love for them. And then I think the third part is I've lived in other countries as well and studied in other countries as well as a young person and as an adult, and having firsthand experience of what that feels like, it's helped me to have some empathy for our students and also to just to connect. And so I love the work that we do, and so I do it because I truly love it. It makes me happy.
I'm Amanda Clare. I'm the director of ELL programs at Uplift Education and Charter School in DFW. Why do I do this work? So I got started in an interview. Actually, I was interviewing for an ELA high school teacher position. And halfway through my interview, they said, you would actually be really great at ESL. How do you feel about that? And I really wanted a job, so I said it sounded great. So I spent my first 3 years working with newcomers at a high school in West Dallas, and just found my passion. And really was drawn in seeing the inequalities that ELLs, especially newcomers at the high school level, experience. And so I do the work because I'm passionate about advocating for these kids and ultimately giving them the same opportunities that I had growing up.
I'm Marie-Sophie Guntram, and I live in Germany in the Cologne area. And I'm an intercultural trainer and a consultant in the public sector.
So if you could wave a magic wand to improve the experience for ELL students, what would you do?
I would eliminate high-stakes testing for our language learners and redo it, I should say, but completely eliminate the way we do it currently. I think there's some flexibility with what ESSA has legislated, although we still have to test our third grade graders in reading and math. And I think the way we do it, we now in Texas, for example, since that's my most recent context, very few language learners can be exempted. It's, you have to be in your first year, you have to be a refugee or an asylee, and that is a small percentage of our language learners. So even if you are a beginner, and it's your second year in the country, you're doing the reading assessment in particular, which really changes, I think, the nature of our instruction. So I think by changing that testing system, that's going to start to change how we work with language learners and the flexibility and the power of really giving students the time they need, the nurturing they need, as well as the rigor to learn English over 5 to 7 years. Some can learn it faster, but that's the average from the research. So I think there's that gap between, of course, there's always going to be the gap between performance for language learners, because the kids who have been reclassified and are not ELLs anymore are grouped into a different set of results on the data. So when we're looking at the gap, we're looking at our English learners who may be early English learners or intermediate, and they still they're still trying to compete with students who are monolingual English background.
I think that's really, I really like that. I would add to that by saying, if I had a magic wand or a magic wiffle ball bat, I'm not sure which one, but I would change the paradigms of people, of educators. You know, I think that one of the biggest challenges that we face, and you know, is really the paradigm of looking at our students as if they're coming to us with a deficit being English learners. And so I think that if I could do anything at all, I would try to change that paradigm or that shift of that perception, so that we could look at our students as coming to us with lots of different opportunities and gifts rather than as a deficit.
I think getting super specific, I would love for my teachers to experience being a second language learner. Really help change and shift their understanding. I think they have a surface level good mindset, but I don't think they have a true understanding to what Chris said, is like that it's not a deficit. And so I think giving them an experience would actually help change and shape the way they taught and even saw our language learners, and really could be the turning point in how they even approached instruction.
I would transform teacher education into the most prestigious, life-changing, thrilling, heartbreaking experience that anyone could ever go through. We're in Germany experiencing a teacher shortage of 40,000 teachers. And in Germany, there are 38,000 schools. So breaking that down means that at every school, there's a minimum of one person missing to teach kids. And that goes to show that on the one hand, we massively miscalculated. And on the other hand, I think it goes to show that teacher education and that the teaching profession is lacking prestige, is lacking a lot of different aspects. And I don't think it's all money. I don't think it's all monetary aspects that people are missing. I think that a lot of the framework within which teachers have to function, more so than actually live and work, is not really working for them anymore. And so if I had the chance to transform teacher education, I would, on the one hand, open it up to all sorts of people. So not just graduates from university, but perhaps people who did TVET training, who went through technical and vocational trainings, who had a career and who want to change career paths, or who are coming from foreign countries, you know. And I would probably also create a path, and there's already a university doing this, but I would probably try to strengthen this program where people with refugee background who have been teaching prior have a chance to enter our public system. And I would start the teaching training experience with students in classrooms and have these experience inside of schools every single year, recur every single year. And I think that the actual subjects probably wouldn't, they would play the secondary role, and the primary role would be didactics and pedagogy and what you really need to be a good teacher. I don't think that math equations are what make a good math teacher. It's the didactics that he or she uses to actually get that message across. And I would supplement teaching training with, you know, like digitization and digital media in the classroom and how to use those kinds of new technologies to actually alleviate some of the pressure that's on you of reteaching the same kind of stuff every single year, and actually being able to just hand that over to a computer and then really being there for your students when you're trying to to transform thinking mechanisms. And yeah, I'm dreaming of this education, teaching education program that would just transform the way you view the world and the ways in which you get equipped to truly form the new generation of students.
And just a follow up to that, so you all have great ideas. So what's stopping you from waving that wand or moving forward in that plan?
Honestly, it's just what's on my plate. I think when you're trying to make sure we're meeting state requirements and adapting all the changes specifically that S is bringing, and really just understanding and getting a network on board with a lot of that, you don't have time. As terrible as that sounds, you don't have the time to make it happen. And then it's also creating the buy-in on the campus level to give that time.
I think we have these entrenched historical barriers with modeling English, English being the right and only way in a lot of places. And shifting away from that is going to take time. It's going to take some clear policy. It's going to take teachers training and district and school level change. So I think it's a multi-pronged set of barriers and also requires that different set of solutions.
The largest barrier for me, I think, is that teaching is still happening in this kind of silo, completely disconnected to other fields of study and other professions, and that needs to change. Teaching needs to be an open, permeable realm where a lot of people get to have a say, and specifically students get to have a say in what's important to them and what their generations are facing and what different cultural groups are facing. And I think unless that happens, unless we open up teacher training programs to these new perspectives, and until it's not just a small group of very, very privileged people who, in my opinion, have lost complete touch to all average life out there, I don't think we're nearing that transformation.
It seems to us there's sort of three categories of, or like a three-pronged approach perhaps, of both what needs to happen and perhaps also what the barriers are. And so those three things, and I'd love for you guys just to talk about this a little bit and what you think is important in each of these and maybe what barriers there are in each. But we see these three categories as being instructional best practices, policies and structures, both at the district or network level, but also at the state and the federal level, and then cultural and social supports for kids. What do you guys think about those three categories and what barriers might fall in them?
So I love that triad, and I think they're all equally important. In my work, I'm currently more so working on cultural aspects, and that always implies a paradigm shift. And paradigm shifts, I think, are most successful when experienced. And I think it'd be really cool for teachers to experience the homes that kids come from. So to actually do home visits. I mean, all these concepts already exist out there, but to kind of implement more ways of experience a paradigm shift and building new relationships would already massively improve the kind of empathy that teachers face their children with. And I think it massively helped them to see that a child is coming from a system of norms, of values, of rules, of beliefs that sometimes feel invisible at school, and that sometimes I feel like kids feel like they need to take off when they walk through the door in order to participate in school life. And so what we're trying to do in my work is we're trying to offer people these kinds of paradigm shifts and experiences where they walk through the world with the eyes of their clients, basically, of the people that they work for, in order to see it from the other side and in order to see the kinds of mistakes that they're making or the faults in the system, and to change it with the people alongside this, what we call sounding board, of people who actually benefit from public, you know, administration or teaching or whatever it may be. And so, it, you know, now that you've asked me about this question, and I'm sure other people can speak to other aspects of this triad, much more eloquently than I can. I'd focus on the cultural aspect and do it the ways in which I just explained.
Looking at the instructional best practices, just kind of starting with that, I don't know how it is all over the place, but we've got a lot of teacher turnover, and we have a lot of administrative turnover. We have constant turnover in our district, and so I think that you have it's sort of overlapping. You've got a lot of really hardworking, good people that are really doing the best that they can with what they've got, but then there are constant administrative changes and constant teacher changes or changes in teaching staff. And so I think it's hard to get, it's one challenge to getting the instructional best practices put into place. I think part of it is just, it's the constant turnover and change. And then I think there's almost like a wait and see attitude by a number of our veteran teachers as well, is that in our district, we've had a new superintendent every year to 2 years for the last, I don't know, forever, since I've been in the district, for whatever reason. And so I think a lot of people are, when a new initiative comes out from a new superintendent, they just sort of want to wait and see if that's really going to take place, because is this person going to be really around? And so I think it's overlapping in the sense that, you know, kind of going back to those cultural and social supports with the perception and paradigm, I think that if we could build a strong base instructionally that is based on what our students need, it wouldn't be if the instructional practices would be accepted.
We have been actually utilizing the opportunity myth that was released by TNTP and really focusing. So we kind of have split it of the instructional practices that happen in the classroom and then looking at intervention and really trying to separate that those two are separate, and what a kid gets in the classroom should be very different than intervention. And so I think for us, it's really focusing, similar to what Chris said, it's the instruction and strategies, but it's also being okay with moving away from what we have always done. And I think what that means is, it's not saying our team has struggled a lot with this, so maybe I'm going to ruffle some feathers here, but things like PSYOP and SILETs, they're great strategies. And do kids grow? Absolutely. But I think it's taking a step back and saying, they're not growing fast enough. Our gap with ELLs, between ELLs and Gen Ed, is the same today that it was, if not greater, than like 20, 25 years ago. And so it's not that it's a bad strategy. It's that it's not enough. And so I think I would say this is something we're wrestling with and trying to figure out and really start to articulate, what do we believe? The TNTP article like brought a lot to light. And I think we're still wrestling with some of that. But I think for us, it's focusing on truly our locus of control when speaking from a district level. Not that we don't advocate for these other pieces, but I think we can get really caught up in, well, I can't change federal, so I can't do anything. But really saying, here is what is in our locus of control.
On the policy front, Texas, since the 70s, has had protections in place for language learners, whereas other states like California, like Massachusetts, have not, and many others, but have recently had that reversal in policy. So California now has Prop 58, and there's this revival of bilingual programs, more support for ESL, and same with Massachusetts. Last year, they reversed that, but in Texas, it's been consistent. So I see, in jumping out of Texas, this different perspective in how we support language learners and what is needed from protection state policy level, federal if possible, but the state has a lot of power, I think, in just paving the way for schools. And in Texas too, you're looking out for that cultural, linguistic, and affective instructional triangle. And so that in itself, being in place in the 70s, is way more powerful than saying you must instruct in English and leaving it at that.
It'd be interesting to pose you all with two big ideas. A bit of a debate, if you will, or a challenge to think about. So basically, I'll share the idea, and we'd love for you to just respond. What do you think of the idea? You can pick it apart, challenge it as you see fit, etc. So the first idea that I'll share is that all schools in the U.S. should become dual language schools, similar to schools in a lot of European and Canada.
So I love the idea. I think when you research really shows that a true dual language model is one of the strongest instructional settings you can put any student in, right? Like native English speaker, native, I'm going to say Spanish because I'm in Texas and that's like where my head is. I think it's a phenomenal concept. And we actually have some really great schools here in the Metroplex that do it well. The challenge I think that I would, you know, want to hear more about is like the staffing model to do a true, true dual language program, do it well. It's a, you know, you have your English days or whatever language, like you have your Chinese day and then you have your English day and it's top to bottom. So it's announcements, it's the cafeteria, lunch lady, like handing, everything is done in that language. And logistically, it is incredibly difficult to implement. So I think I would have questions about that, but that on it, honestly, in a perfect world, that's what I would push here in Uplift, especially from like an IB mindset. So I probably don't have a lot of pushback other than talk to me logistics and I'm on board.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well, is that that'd be wonderful, but how, you know, the logistics of it just kind of make my left eye twitch a little bit. Certainly, yeah. I would love to see something like that. It's absolutely brilliant. It's beautiful.
Hard to debate because I'm on board as well. I think, you know, we have the seal of biliteracy as a credential you can earn in high school now. We also have early dual programs in some places, but then there's this gap in the middle, I feel like, unless your dual language program goes through eighth grade, which is so rare, and it's... high school, what does that look like for dual language? Which subjects are in what language? And that often comes down to staffing. I also think the staffing piece is a puzzle, but if we could make movement toward being dual language schools, I think the staffing would follow, the credentials of the teachers would follow, and it would be this other mindset, like you said, Amanda, of language learning for adults. If that were the norm, as it is in many other countries, I think that would actually shift some elements of equity for our schools around the country as well, for our kids.
I think it would shake up the whole system and it would totally transform the system, and it would value first and foremost the richness that comes with more languages and a kind of linguistically rich environment. And it would value the norms that come with different linguistic systems, because language transmits much, much more than just meaning. It transmits values and worldviews and beliefs and sorrows and doubts and joys. And I think it's a really, really interesting idea.
What pushback do you think there would be?
Language is power. And that by using a certain language and not using other languages, we are strengthening the monopoly on power. And by sharing and leveraging this privilege and opening it up to new languages and using new language systems to open up a whole new cross-cultural dialogue, you're giving up. I think in the first moment, it will feel like you're giving up some of that power. And then in the second step, I think you'd realize that it's not a zero-sum game where if I win some, you lose some, or vice versa, and where it's more so a 1+1=3 type equation. I think that's what would happen down the road. But with anything that has to do with integration and inclusion, there is going to be that paradox of huge negotiation processes that are going to be more or less successful in the first couple of months or years or trials.
That's a perfect segue to the second big idea, which is that there should be specific recruitment and training of a teaching force that moves towards all teachers being bilingual, and requiring all students or all teachers to be bilingual. What do you think about that idea?
Where do I sign up? How do we do that? You mean all teachers, like every single teacher, everyone?
Every single one.
You know, I don't know what it is, you know, with us, with languages, you know, I don't know why we have such pushback in this, in my opinion, is, you know, based on some of my experiences, that there's a lot of pushback in learning another language. It's I don't know if it's nationalism, maybe it's nationalism or something like that. Xenophobia, fear. I don't know. It seems like there's such a there's a bias to being bilingual or multilingual in a lot of ways. This is the United States of America, speak English, that kind of idea. I would love to see more modern language programs, more dual language programs, more immersion programs. I just kind of come back to my original point is I can't, you know, it's that paradigm. It's that hardness of heart that is a big, big challenge. And then you have the logistics of trying to get everyone to be bilingual. It's a lofty dream. It's a lovely idea. I'd work along with you for that. I just don't know about the logistics of getting that to play out.
Yeah, it would take generations.
Yeah, it would take.
Yeah, let's start now.
Yeah.
I could definitely see the pushback from a lot of people who feel like they are not bilingual or have tried and they had a few years of language in high school and they just didn't pick up on her. They feel like they're not good at language learning.
This really moves me. I think language touches on some of our most emotional inner depths, and learning a new language means that you're opening up your emotional space to other ways of living in the world and being in the world and, you know, being a different instrument in the world. And signaling to kids that bilingualism or multilingualism is one of the most beautiful things you can own and cherish and have for yourself and to share with the world for the rest of your life, I think is one of the most powerful messages that we can send. And I wouldn't necessarily turn it into a requirement because there are different types of languages out there. I mean, you can have a programmer, you know, who speaks a different programming language fluently in terms of HTML or Python or whatever. But by the virtue of opening up a discussion of bilingualism being the norm rather than a weird thing that changes the dynamic between people and that automatically puts somebody down would be extremely helpful in the world that we live in, because it is a very diverse world that's on the one hand moving closer together and on the other hand, you know, experiencing more and more divides and fissures in society.
The final question to hopefully leave us in a positive place is, what's your biggest hope for this work? What gives you optimism for moving forward?
Being in the schools and seeing, you know, our students and working with our families on a daily basis, that fills me with hope and optimism, because I see how much love there is, how much positivity is, how much positive energy there is. And so that's what fills me with hope and optimism, is when I get to work with people and people like yourselves as well.
Kids walking in the classrooms every day and listening to them. We've been really blessed as a district to have many of our former students come back as teachers and want to continue the change they saw. And so I think the hope that we have to come is what really grounds me in continuing and just seeing really their passion to continue. And that honestly, even when we've done it wrong and we're still working to get it right, we're still making change and remembering that's, you know, forward progress, whether an inch or a mile is all we ask, and just to continue moving that way.
I think I'm going to take that big picture again, because I've been looking across the country, but that seal of biliteracy is growing in popularity. There are 35 states now who've adopted it, 12 within the last 2 years, I believe. And there are goals popping up around that too. So in Oakland, for example, they want to double their number of students earning the seal of biliteracy by 2020. Dual language practices growing. San Antonio went from 2 dual language campuses to 45 in 1 year. And they're figuring out how to make sure that's quality and sustainable. But that was a giant boost that shows the popularity. And then the research is there as well, more and more, support multilingualism, and it hasn't been as strong in the past, in particular kids' bilingual trajectories and how they do progress when they're learning two languages in a school. There's not a ton of experimental research on that because it's illegal, but there's more in terms of like lottery data and ways to parse that out and know how language is developed, and as that becomes more known, I think I have more hope that testing, that instructional practices can shift in schools for students.
I approach every part of my project, every single phase, with a growth mindset, because I think that a lot of what people need to transform their own place of work or their own place of life, their own community, they already have. And that's their values, that's their history, that's their ties, their kinships. And if we grow aware of what we already have, and if we realize that we can use what we already have for the better and to manage change and to actually mold change into something that creates a more beautiful place than we found it, I think I can wrap up projects and know that this big word sustainability actually happens because people are equipped and, more importantly, they're encouraged to actually do this work by themselves and to not just have change wash all over them and be paralyzed by change, but to actually see change as the opportunity to take matters into their own hands and change the system for the better, because systems are no other thing than many different humans trying to make something work.
Throughout our research and throughout our conversations and interviews with educators, we discovered that the best practices for supporting EL students were framed in three categories: instructional best practices, policies and structures at district, state, and federal level, and cultural and social supports. Each resource and expert seemed to have a different perspective on which change was most necessary to support students. And so Marissa and I were really left with the question of what is the key lever for change for our ELL students?
We brainstormed some potential next steps that could really push this work forward. They come in different layers in the educational system. In terms of teacher recruitment and certification, we could explore ways to increase the pipeline of educators from backgrounds and languages similar to those of students. Ensure certification includes a piece around support for language acquisition for all teachers.
Similar to that, we think there might be a solution in teacher training. We could build robust cultural competence and language acquisition training programs that would better equip teachers in supporting students of all backgrounds.
At the district level, we can ensure systems and programs are aligned to the goals in supporting EL students and families, making sure these policies are longstanding and ingrained in the policies to ensure that there isn't too much turnover as personnel changes from year to year.
Local and state education agencies could create new policies that encourage multiple language programs across all districts and schools. They could also dismantle policies that inhibit bilingual and dual language education programs from pre-K to 12. Some states allow it in different grades, but most states don't allow dual language in 8th through 12th grade.
Lastly, there's a role that higher education institutions can play in this work. They have the opportunity to reform admissions and recruitment processes to better ensure that multilingual students gain advantage and opportunity and preference in programs.
Although each of these strategies could make radical impact on our education system and create more opportunities, deep down, the hard work is the most important. Our nation needs to begin to value language and culture in multiple ways. As Sophie shared in the roundtable, language is power. And those in power in our country need to begin to do the hard work to understand that we can share power and that we can value all in our nation. And until this happens, until the hard work happens, we will not make significant changes in this area.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Marissa and I hope that each of you are walking away feeling more equipped and more hopeful in our work as we move forward to ensure an equitable education for all children.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through the restless and patient continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world, with the world, and with each other. The solution is not to integrate them into the structure of oppression, but to transform that structure so that they become beings for themselves. Liberation is a practice of action and reflection upon the world.